Cambridge Certificate of Proficiency in English Listening Test. Ahead Books. Written by Sean Houghton. Test 2. I'm going to give you the instructions for this test. I shall introduce each part of the test and give you time to look at the questions. At the start of each piece, you will hear this sound. You will hear each piece twice. Remember, while you're listening, write your answers on the question paper. You will have 5 minutes at the end of the real test to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. In the exam, there would now be a pause. Please ask any questions you have during the pause, because you must not speak during the test. Now open your question paper and look at part one. You will hear three different extracts. For questions 1 to 6, choose the answer A, B or C, which fits best according to what you hear. There are two questions for each extract. Extract 1. You will hear Nicola and Joel, two panellists on a current affairs show, discussing the hosting of the next Rugby World Cup.
I was initially pessimistic about the government's campaign to bring the next Rugby World Cup to our country, not because I don't think we have the required fan base to support it, but because I would have had reservations about the vast amounts of money it will be necessary to spend, and whether there will be any long-term benefit from such spending. One need only look to places like Athens and Rio, where big global events were held in the past. There, much of the new infrastructure now lies abandoned and unused. Such a wasted opportunity.
Yes, Nicola, but you're referring to the Olympics. Hosting the Rugby World Cup, you must surely agree, is not an investment on quite the same scale. Besides, much of the infrastructure is already in place. The government's feasibility study clearly showed that we have an existing transport and hospitality network capable of coping, and that no major modifications to our stadia will be necessary.
I think, Joel, for a small country like ours, the hosting of the Rugby World Cup is as challenging as is hosting an Olympics for larger countries. Therefore, I don't buy into that aspect of your argument. But I did say I was initially pessimistic. I must admit, that report you cite has indeed allayed some of my fears about spending. I was initially pessimistic about the government's campaign to bring the next Rugby World Cup to our country, not because I don't think we have the required fan base to support it, but because I would have had reservations about the vast amounts of money it will be necessary to spend, and whether there will be any long-term benefit from such spending. One need only look to places like Athens and Rio, where big global events were held in the past. There, much of the new infrastructure now lies abandoned and unused. Such a wasted opportunity.
Yes, Nicola, but you're referring to the Olympics. Hosting the Rugby World Cup, you must surely agree, is not an investment on quite the same scale. Besides, much of the infrastructure is already in place. The government's feasibility study clearly showed that we have an existing transport and hospitality network capable of coping, and that no major modifications to our stadia will be necessary.
I think, Joel, for a small country like ours, the hosting of the Rugby World Cup is as challenging as is hosting an Olympics for larger countries. Therefore, I don't buy into that aspect of your argument. But I did say I was initially pessimistic. I must admit, that report you cite has indeed allayed some of my fears about spending.
Extract 2. You will hear part of a radio discussion about language apps by two linguists, Sarah and Dan.
I don't want to sound like an app basher or a traditionalist, but I think the excitement surrounding language apps is a little overhyped. If the apps introduce more people to language learning, don't get me wrong, this is not to be sniffed at. And I'm not here to question recent reports suggesting this may very well be the case. However, it is a very superficial sort of exposure. Language acquisition requires a more committed approach. I think app developers ought to set the expectations of their learners, customers, at the right level and not make facetious claims, Sarah.
Dan, I would give the developers a little more credit. Firstly, because you must bear in mind that a lot of these new language apps are free. People are always calling for tech companies to have a more social conscience in their approach and not simply be profit-driven. Should we not be applauding this? Furthermore, just to expand on something you mentioned, not only did the report suggest higher take-up rates due to the availability of language apps, it also suggests, surprisingly, that many users tend to persevere with their language learning after sampling the app. So it is not some novelty or fad, in other words. I wouldn't be so deluded as to suggest we don't need greater levels of immersion than apps offer to acquire a second or subsequent language. But if they open the door for many people, I'm not going to criticize them for that.
I don't want to sound like an app basher or a traditionalist, but I think the excitement surrounding language apps is a little overhyped. If the apps introduce more people to language learning, don't get me wrong, this is not to be sniffed at. And I'm not here to question recent reports suggesting this may very well be the case. However, it is a very superficial sort of exposure. Language acquisition requires a more committed approach. I think app developers ought to set the expectations of their learners, customers, at the right level and not make facetious claims, Sarah.
Dan, I would give the developers a little more credit. Firstly, because you must bear in mind that a lot of these new language apps are free. People are always calling for tech companies to have a more social conscience in their approach and not simply be profit-driven. Should we not be applauding this? Furthermore, just to expand on something you mentioned, not only did the report suggest higher take-up rates due to the availability of language apps, it also suggests, surprisingly, that many users tend to persevere with their language learning after sampling the app. So it is not some novelty or fad, in other words. I wouldn't be so deluded as to suggest we don't need greater levels of immersion than apps offer to acquire a second or subsequent language. But if they open the door for many people, I'm not going to criticize them for that.
Extract 3. You will hear an astrophysicist called Paul being interviewed on the radio about the Aurora Borealis.
How likely are aurora sightings from the UK, Paul?
Well, this is not a straightforward answer. Using a camera in the northern aspects of the mainland, the likelihood of aurora spotting on clear nights in winter is actually quite high. Of course, on overcast nights, you can forget it irrespective of your location. Spotting the aurora with the naked eye, however, is much rarer even in the optimal locations. This is very infrequent indeed and requires dedication. You only stand a chance far away from habitation with very clear skies. Now, in the rest of mainland UK, only the most favourable conditions with the strongest auroras mean there is any likelihood of spotting them with digital equipment, and you would be very fortunate indeed to do so with your biological lenses, so to speak.
So, for those desiring to optimise their chances of seeing the phenomenon, what advice do you have?
Well, first and foremost, I think if you really desire to see it, you must go further north than any point on our own mainland. I'm talking Scandinavia, basically. Time of year is essential, too. Whilst the phenomenon is not exclusively a winter one, bear in mind that night time is not sufficiently dark during the summer months the further north you go. The aurora may indeed occur overhead, but you will be oblivious to it. In the heart of winter, then, in Scandinavia, and preferably far, far away from habitation. If you can only holiday in summer, though, all is not lost. Remember that the far south boasts its own similar phenomenon, and there the seasons are reversed. So viewing is optimal during our summer. However, that's going to perhaps mean Antarctica, which is a very costly endeavour.
How likely are aurora sightings from the UK, Paul?
Well, this is not a straightforward answer. Using a camera in the northern aspects of the mainland, the likelihood of aurora spotting on clear nights in winter is actually quite high. Of course, on overcast nights, you can forget it irrespective of your location. Spotting the aurora with the naked eye, however, is much rarer even in the optimal locations. This is very infrequent indeed and requires dedication. You only stand a chance far away from habitation with very clear skies. Now, in the rest of mainland UK, only the most favourable conditions with the strongest auroras mean there is any likelihood of spotting them with digital equipment, and you would be very fortunate indeed to do so with your biological lenses, so to speak.
So, for those desiring to optimise their chances of seeing the phenomenon, what advice do you have?
Well, first and foremost, I think if you really desire to see it, you must go further north than any point on our own mainland. I'm talking Scandinavia, basically. Time of year is essential, too. Whilst the phenomenon is not exclusively a winter one, bear in mind that night time is not sufficiently dark during the summer months the further north you go. The aurora may indeed occur overhead, but you will be oblivious to it. In the heart of winter, then, in Scandinavia, and preferably far, far away from habitation. If you can only holiday in summer, though, all is not lost. Remember that the far south boasts its own similar phenomenon, and there the seasons are reversed. So viewing is optimal during our summer. However, that's going to perhaps mean Antarctica, which is a very costly endeavour.
That is the end of part one. Now turn to part two. You will hear a radio presenter called Simone Poole discussing the origin of the superstitions surrounding Friday the 13th. For questions 7 to 15, complete the sentences with a word or short phrase. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part two.
Hello and welcome to the programme. I'm Simone Poole, and what with the day being what it is, this being Friday the 13th and all, I thought we'd start the show by taking a look at some of the superstitions people have about today and where those superstitions come from. And it's no laughing matter because some of us take Friday the 13th very seriously indeed. There's even a word used to describe those who have a genuine phobia about the date. Paraskaidika triophobia. This is derived from Greek and literally means fear of Friday the 13th. According to research conducted by a popular chain of hotels, almost 75% of adults in the UK claim to have suffered from bad luck at some point in time on this day. And speaking of hotels, given that the digit is associated with misfortune, did you know that many go so far as to skip 13 altogether in their floor numbering system? So, for example, you may find that your hotel lift can take you from floor 12 direct to floor 14, with floor 13 simply not existing at all. So, as you can see, the fear, or superstition, is very real. Indeed, the Society of the Motor Industry in Ireland was so concerned about the public's discomfort surrounding the number 13 that it completely changed the registration number plate system. For fear that the number 13 appearing on car plates would hit sales, a new registration system was introduced for the start of 2013 and has been in operation ever since. Further evidence of the public's fear of this unlucky digit can be found in the fact that, according to one online property agency, house buyers can make savings of up to £9,000 if they're willing to call number 13 their new home. But why all the fuss? What is it about the number 13 that makes us so superstitious? Well, there are many theories for the origin of this illogical fear. For instance, in Norse mythology, the superstition can be traced back to the banquet at Valhalla, where the god of mischief caused chaos when he turned up unannounced as the 13th guest. Then there are religious references too. For instance, Friday was the day Eve tempted Adam with the apple from the tree of knowledge, and it also marked the start of the great flood during the time of Noah. Numerous other references with negative connotations for both Friday and the number 13 can also be found elsewhere in religious texts. From the world of literature, Thomas W. Lawson's novel Friday the 13th, published in 1907, may have added fuel to the fire of and popularized the superstition surrounding the day. Lawson's story tells of the deeds of an unscrupulous banker on Wall Street who takes advantage of the superstitions around the 13th to cause widespread panic and chaos in the markets. In parts of the Mediterranean, though, whilst the number 13 is similarly associated with misfortune, it is Tuesday and not Friday. In Spain and Greece, for example, which is synonymous with bad luck. Tuesday the 13th, then, would be regarded there as the greatest calendrical omen of misfortune. However, the number 13 has not always been associated with misfortune. Indeed, the ancient Egyptians regarded it as a lucky number, believing that the 13th stage of life was related to the afterlife, a sort of higher spiritual state of being. Indeed, although Friday the 13th is a widely held superstition today, closer examination at local level of perception of the day and date in different cultures tends to be quite revealing. It really is interesting that the whole idea of Friday the 13th...
Now you will hear part two again.
Hello and welcome to the programme. I'm Simone Poole, and what with the day being what it is, this being Friday the 13th and all, I thought we'd start the show by taking a look at some of the superstitions people have about today and where those superstitions come from. And it's no laughing matter because some of us take Friday the 13th very seriously indeed. There's even a word used to describe those who have a genuine phobia about the date. Paraskaidika triophobia. This is derived from Greek and literally means fear of Friday the 13th. According to research conducted by a popular chain of hotels, almost 75% of adults in the UK claim to have suffered from bad luck at some point in time on this day. And speaking of hotels, given that the digit is associated with misfortune, did you know that many go so far as to skip 13 altogether in their floor numbering system? So, for example, you may find that your hotel lift can take you from floor 12 direct to floor 14, with floor 13 simply not existing at all. So, as you can see, the fear, or superstition, is very real. Indeed, the Society of the Motor Industry in Ireland was so concerned about the public's discomfort surrounding the number 13 that it completely changed the registration number plate system. For fear that the number 13 appearing on car plates would hit sales, a new registration system was introduced for the start of 2013 and has been in operation ever since. Further evidence of the public's fear of this unlucky digit can be found in the fact that, according to one online property agency, house buyers can make savings of up to £9,000 if they're willing to call number 13 their new home. But why all the fuss? What is it about the number 13 that makes us so superstitious? Well, there are many theories for the origin of this illogical fear. For instance, in Norse mythology, the superstition can be traced back to the banquet at Valhalla, where the god of mischief caused chaos when he turned up unannounced as the 13th guest. Then there are religious references too. For instance, Friday was the day Eve tempted Adam with the apple from the tree of knowledge, and it also marked the start of the great flood during the time of Noah. Numerous other references with negative connotations for both Friday and the number 13 can also be found elsewhere in religious texts. From the world of literature, Thomas W. Lawson's novel Friday the 13th, published in 1907, may have added fuel to the fire of and popularized the superstition surrounding the day. Lawson's story tells of the deeds of an unscrupulous banker on Wall Street who takes advantage of the superstitions around the 13th to cause widespread panic and chaos in the markets. In parts of the Mediterranean, though, whilst the number 13 is similarly associated with misfortune, it is Tuesday and not Friday, in Spain and Greece, for example, which is synonymous with bad luck. Tuesday the 13th, then, would be regarded there as the greatest calendrical omen of misfortune. However, the number 13 has not always been associated with misfortune. Indeed, the ancient Egyptians regarded it as a lucky number, believing that the 13th stage of life was related to the afterlife, a sort of higher spiritual state of being. Indeed, although Friday the 13th is a widely held superstition today, closer examination at local level of perception of the day and date in different cultures tends to be quite revealing. It really is interesting that the whole idea of Friday the 13th
That is the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You will hear a radio program in which two athletes, Julia Im and Darren Finn, are discussing their success at a recent athletics event. For questions 16 to 20, choose the answer A, B, C or D, which fits best according to what you hear. You now have 1 minute in which to look at part three.
Now a warm welcome to local heroes Julia Im and Darren Finn, who have just returned from the World Championships with gold medals in their respective disciplines. Julia, first to you. Hearty congratulations on being the first tennis player from the country, never mind the district, to have medaled at the Games. Julia, why has it taken so long in your opinion?
Well, had you asked me that question when I was starting out in the sport, I would have said the infrastructure was lacking. However, that has come on in leaps and bounds in recent years. Likewise, our once inadequate coaching system is now on a par with the best and sets the standard internationally, I feel. Indeed, we always had willing coaches, but as a nation relatively new to this sport, I think what we were lacking was the experience and expertise. The policy of inviting coaches from elsewhere in the world to lead our program has paid dividends in a big way. It has added a level of professionalism to the program that has given our athletes the edge. Granted, there has been a huge increase in financial investment alongside the investment in human resources, but, as we have seen from examples in other sports, that alone is not sufficient by any means.
Darren, you have also tasted success in one of our newer disciplines. Do you feel the same way as Julia?
Well, on the back of my success, we are due to see a hugely significant increase in funding going forward. This has been approved by the government, but we won't know whether or not the improved funding will make a difference for some time. What I can say for sure, then, is that even lacking appropriate funding, the evidence of my success clearly demonstrates that we can overachieve with professional coaching mechanisms in place. And, at present, the best coaches are indeed foreign, so attracting them here to train us has made a massive difference. And with the new investment we are expecting to receive now, hopefully the infrastructure will also improve, leading to further success at future championships.
How, Darren, were you able to achieve so much in light, as you say, of patently having so little by way of resources at your disposal compared to competitors in other countries?
Well, aside from the coaching, which I've already highlighted as pivotal, I personally was fortunate to attain private sponsorship for my training. This allowed me to focus full-time on achieving my goals. The majority of my colleagues have not been so lucky. Sports grants are given out only in disciplines where our athletes do well. So, up until now, we have had to self-finance our training, and most of my colleagues do this by holding down a job. We cannot be expected to compete with full-time professionals when, for all intents and purposes, we are still operating in an amateur system. The dire situation, lack of interest and funding, certainly motivated me to do as well as I could, knowing full well that success would ensure better support for myself and my colleagues in future.
Indeed, many people are critical about the sports funding system in this country. Clearly, Darren feels that his sport was somewhat neglected. Do you think the funding system is fair, Julia?
Obviously, in an ideal world, all sports would be funded equally. But we must be realistic here. There is limited investment to go around, and we are in a results-driven environment. The reason, for example, that my discipline is well funded today, where that was not so in the past, is simple. It is because we, my fellow athletes and I, have been making tangible progress for some time now. My success was only a matter of time. I do feel athletes must justify their funding. We must spend smartly in this country in order to maximise the return in terms of medal success.
That's a fair point, Darren, isn't it? There simply isn't enough money to go around, so investment decisions must be results-based.
Perhaps if such decisions were truly taken based on this criterion, I might see that it's fair. But answer me this. Why then does long-distance running receive such a disproportionate amount of funding? After all, when was the last time we medaled there? In reality, certain traditional disciplines attract more investment than warranted or deserved, while other, smaller, newer ones, like my own, are neglected. I believe the approval process is biased towards traditional disciplines because most of the investment board members come from them. We ought to have an independent panel approving grants and so forth instead.
I see. So a need for greater transparency is what we should be striving for.
Now you will hear part three again.
Now a warm welcome to local heroes Julia Im and Darren Finn, who have just returned from the World Championships with gold medals in their respective disciplines. Julia, first to you. Hearty congratulations on being the first tennis player from the country, never mind the district, to have medaled at the Games. Julia, why has it taken so long, in your opinion?
Well, had you asked me that question when I was starting out in the sport, I would have said the infrastructure was lacking. However, that has come on in leaps and bounds in recent years. Likewise, our once inadequate coaching system is now on a par with the best and sets the standard internationally, I feel. Indeed, we always had willing coaches, but as a nation relatively new to this sport, I think what we were lacking was the experience and expertise. The policy of inviting coaches from elsewhere in the world to lead our program has paid dividends in a big way. It has added a level of professionalism to the program that has given our athletes the edge. Granted, there has been a huge increase in financial investment alongside the investment in human resources, but, as we have seen from examples in other sports, that alone is not sufficient by any means.
Darren, you have also tasted success in one of our newer disciplines. Do you feel the same way as Julia?
Well, on the back of my success, we are due to see a hugely significant increase in funding going forward. This has been approved by the government, but we won't know whether or not the improved funding will make a difference for some time. What I can say for sure, then, is that even lacking appropriate funding, the evidence of my success clearly demonstrates that we can overachieve with professional coaching mechanisms in place. And, at present, the best coaches are indeed foreign, so attracting them here to train us has made a massive difference. And with the new investment we are expecting to receive now, hopefully the infrastructure will also improve, leading to further success at future championships.
How, Darren, were you able to achieve so much in light, as you say, of patently having so little by way of resources at your disposal compared to competitors in other countries?
Well, aside from the coaching, which I've already highlighted as pivotal, I, personally, was fortunate to attain private sponsorship for my training. This allowed me to focus full-time on achieving my goals. The majority of my colleagues have not been so lucky. Sports grants are given out only in disciplines where our athletes do well. So, up until now, we have had to self-finance our training, and most of my colleagues do this by holding down a job. We cannot be expected to compete with full-time professionals when, for all intents and purposes, we are still operating in an amateur system. The dire situation, lack of interest and funding, certainly motivated me to do as well as I could, knowing full well that success would ensure better support for myself and my colleagues in future.
Indeed, many people are critical about the sports funding system in this country. Clearly, Darren feels that his sport was somewhat neglected. Do you think the funding system is fair, Julia?
Obviously, in an ideal world, all sports would be funded equally. But we must be realistic here. There is limited investment to go around, and we are in a results-driven environment. The reason, for example, that my discipline is well funded today, where that was not so in the past, is simple. It is because we, my fellow athletes and I, have been making tangible progress for some time now. My success was only a matter of time. I do feel athletes must justify their funding. We must spend smartly in this country in order to maximise the return in terms of medal success.
That's a fair point, Darren, isn't it? There simply isn't enough money to go around, so investment decisions must be results-based.
Perhaps if such decisions were truly taken based on this criterion, I might see that it's fair. But answer me this. Why then does long-distance running receive such a disproportionate amount of funding? After all, when was the last time we medalled there? In reality, certain traditional disciplines attract more investment than warranted or deserved, while other smaller, newer ones, like my own, are neglected. I believe the approval process is biased towards traditional disciplines because most of the investment board members come from them. We ought to have an independent panel approving grants and so forth instead.
I see. So a need for greater transparency is what we should be striving for.
That is the end of part 3. Now turn to part 4. Part 4 consists of 2 tasks. You will hear 5 short extracts in which young actors talk about their path into the discipline. Look at task 1. For questions 21 to 25, choose from the list A to H, what each speaker says about how their career started. Now look at task 2. For questions 26 to 30, choose from the list A to H, what each speaker dislikes about their profession. While you listen, you must complete both tasks. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part 4. Speaker 1.
I'm not normally a bag of nerves, and thankfully I think my cool demeanour has really helped me cope with my newfound fame. Friends call me the accidental movie star, but what they don't realise is it had nothing to do with luck. Just a whole lot of dedication. My big break came because I'd been doing amateur theatre for ages and taking professional acting classes. I wasn't simply spotted, I earned my shot. The best thing about acting? It's the limelight. I'm not a shy boy. The worst thing? Well, there's nothing glamorous about the hours we have to put in on set, let me tell you.
Speaker 2.
My elder sister started out as a child model, and she appeared in a number of TV commercials. Everyone thought she'd be the big star, but that was really my parents' influence. She wasn't really interested in the limelight herself. As for me, I went for my first audition as a dare. It was for a part in a new TV sitcom, and much to my amazement, I got called for a second reading. The part went elsewhere in the end, but I suddenly realised I wasn't half bad at this and began to take it seriously. After all, what a job! What I love most is getting rave reviews, although, contrary-wise, I must admit it's hard not to take the negative ones to heart.
Speaker 3.
My father was a film director and my mum a screenwriter, so I was always around the set as a young child. My ambition back then was to be just like my dad and follow in his footsteps. But when one of the child actors pulled out of one of the shoots last minute, well, he had a big crisis and little option but to cast me. That's when we discovered being in front of the camera suited me better. I think, truthfully, that my connections have aided my swift progress, but I don't doubt my talent either. People who say you can get to the top just by who you know are kidding themselves. I still love spending time around the set where my dad works, but we avoid the same projects, as it's just awkward, to be honest. Besides, I get a kick out of working with different directors all the time and learning something new from each of them.
Speaker 4.
I started out directing short films at school, and I would sometimes not have enough cast members and have to cast myself. A talent scout spotted me in one of my productions and signed me up to his agency, and things moved on really swiftly from there. I love having the opportunity to travel to so many different set locations. I only lament the fact that I don't get to spend more time enjoying the places I visit, but I wouldn't swap this job for the world.
Speaker 5.
I always shunned the limelight as a kid and kind of withdrew from things and hid in the background. When we had to make a film as part of an art class project, I reluctantly found myself in front of the camera. Little did I expect that there I would be a person transformed. I totally came out of my shell. On screen, I am a flamboyant and charismatic person, isn't that funny? Whereas off-screen, I'm just the same as I always was, which makes dealing with my publicity and media commitments difficult. The best thing about the job is the job itself, and I wish I could just hide away from all the rest.
Now you will hear part 4 again. Speaker 1.
I'm not normally a bag of nerves, and thankfully I think my cool demeanour has really helped me cope with my newfound fame. Friends call me the accidental movie star, but what they don't realise is it had nothing to do with luck. Just a whole lot of dedication. My big break came because I'd been doing amateur theatre for ages and taking professional acting classes. I wasn't simply spotted, I earned my shot. The best thing about acting? It's the limelight. I'm not a shy boy. The worst thing? Well, there's nothing glamorous about the hours we have to put in on set, let me tell you.
Speaker 2.
My elder sister started out as a child model, and she appeared in a number of TV commercials. Everyone thought she'd be the big star, but that was really my parents' influence. She wasn't really interested in the limelight herself. As for me, I went for my first audition as a dare. It was for a part in a new TV sitcom, and much to my amazement, I got called for a second reading. The part went elsewhere in the end, but I suddenly realised I wasn't half bad at this and began to take it seriously. After all, what a job! What I love most is getting rave reviews, although, contrary-wise, I must admit it's hard not to take the negative ones to heart.
Speaker 3.
My father was a film director and my mum a screenwriter, so I was always around the set as a young child. My ambition back then was to be just like my dad and follow in his footsteps. But when one of the child actors pulled out of one of the shoots last minute, well, he had a big crisis and little option but to cast me. That's when we discovered being in front of the camera suited me better. I think, truthfully, that my connections have aided my swift progress, but I don't doubt my talent either. People who say you can get to the top just by who you know are kidding themselves. I still love spending time around the set where my dad works, but we avoid the same projects, as it's just awkward, to be honest. Besides, I get a kick out of working with different directors all the time and learning something new from each of them.
Speaker 4.
I started out directing short films at school, and I would sometimes not have enough cast members and have to cast myself. A talent scout spotted me in one of my productions and signed me up to his agency, and things moved on really swiftly from there. I love having the opportunity to travel to so many different set locations. I only lament the fact that I don't get to spend more time enjoying the places I visit, but I wouldn't swap this job for the world.
Speaker 5.
I always shunned the limelight as a kid and kind of withdrew from things and hid in the background. When we had to make a film as part of an art class project, I reluctantly found myself in front of the camera. Little did I expect that there I would be a person transformed. I totally came out of my shell. On screen, I am a flamboyant and charismatic person. Isn't that funny? Whereas off-screen, I'm just the same as I always was, which makes dealing with my publicity and media commitments difficult. The best thing about the job is the job itself, and I wish I could just hide away from all the rest.
That is the end of part 4. In the actual test, there would now be a pause of 5 minutes for you to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. Be sure to follow the numbering of all the questions. The examiner shall remind you when there's 1 minute left, so that you're sure to finish in time.